Today's episode of Darkness Radio is brought to you by BlueChew.com. Try Blue Chew free when you use our promo code DARKNESS at checkout. Just pay $5 shipping. That's BlueChew.com, promo code DARKNESS to receive your first month free. Visit BlueChew.com for more details and important safety information. And we thank BlueChew.com for sponsoring our podcast. Welcome in to the best in paranormal programming. This is Darkness Radio. I'm Tim Dennis. We're getting down to T-minus, D-Day. We're getting down to that time where I get to lay down on a table and have a heart ablation. Now, I'll tell you something here, folks. I don't normally like to expose my life, pull back the curtain, tell you guys a lot about myself, and there's a reason for that. One, there needs to be a healthy relationship between you, the listener, and I, the host of this show. Let's face it, you guys don't send me letters and phone me and send me emails telling me all about yourselves. Maybe or maybe not, there's a healthy boundary there between you and I as to, you know, you probably shouldn't know every little thing about me either. But there is one thing between you and I that I feel is like an open book. We should discuss it ad nauseum, put it that way. And that is death and near-death experiences. And I'll be honest with you, I'm going to rip back the curtain here and rip back a little bit of my soul. And I'm going to tell you right now, I'm a little scared for Friday morning. And, you know, there's a few of you in the audience that have probably had heart ablation surgery are probably going, oh, come on, Tim, you know, suck it up, you know, hike up your skirt, whatever. I know I'm using an outdated phrase and shame on Tim. I know there's a few of you out there who've had it or going, you got nothing to worry about, Tim. This is an easy surgery, 80% success rate on the first try. You really shouldn't be that worried. But here's what worries me. I don't have the best of luck when it comes to major surgeries, and I don't recuperate very well. Maybe I don't trust my body as much as I should because my body has failed me at times. So I'm a little nervous. That, you know, and I'm not trying to jinx myself. I believe in my head that things will go very, very smoothly. And I'll tell you something. This electrophysicist who's doing the surgery, Dr. Rukos, man, if you could bottle confidence, this guy is so confident. If you bottled his confidence as electrical energy, you could power 8 major cities with it. He is so confident that I really can't help but be confident when I get into that emergency room. So you may be saying, well, Tim, what's your problem then? What's your issue? Why are you whining, bitching, and complaining on the air as to whether you'll have an issue? Well, because you can't be 100% certain about anything. Nothing in this life is certain. So I got thinking to myself, okay, what happens if I have that experience? You know, the last time I was in the hospital and I had something major happening, it was sepsis because of an operation on my Charcot foot that didn't go right. They tried to flatten my Charcot foot. They took a saw and tried to flatten that Charcot foot out. And the bone saw left some bacteria on the bone. It always does. You can't sterilize a bone saw. So then when they put the foot vac down on my foot, because my foot wouldn't seal together properly, it drew out the bacteria out of the bone, put it into my bloodstream, and ta-da, I've got sepsis. Now I'm in the hospital and I'm fighting for my life. And I come within, I don't know, 30 seconds to a minute of losing my life. I hear the nurses counting down my blood sugar and my blood pressure, and I hear, we're losing them. And all I saw was the edges of the room go black. I didn't have that near-death experience that everybody has. And then I come back. And there's a Jamaican nurse, like I've said many times on the show, trying to fill my mouth full of this yellow, lemony-tasting, snotty consistency gel that's supposed to get my blood sugar back up. And she's yelling at me, we're not losing you today, boy, or whatever it is she was yelling. And there I am in my bed. And I thought, but I didn't see anything. And that shook me a little, not going to lie. Today, we're going to talk about near-death experiences. And I'm going to try and shake a little bit of this trepidation I have. It's not a fear. It's just a trepidation. I've seen too much. I know too much. I've talked to too many people over 17 years of this show to know that there's just blackness on the other side. I know that there's something, but I want to kind of know what it is. And I want to know what to do if I do that and have that happen again and there's nothing. Is it my fault? Did I not do something right? And what do I have to do to move past it or move on? So I brought in a guy today who's hopefully going to help me with that. Dr. Scott Taylor is the president of the Expanded Awareness Institute, EAI, a little bit of dyslexia there, helps people interested in near-death and shared-death experiences explore what that experience means to them and to our culture as a whole. Taylor has served as president and executive director of the Monroe Institute. He has been a trainer for the Monroe Institute since 1985. He is an expert in the use of binaural beat technology to achieve and hold expanded states of consciousness. Scott's gift is the ability to make the exploration of the non-physical universe accessible to the curious. Scott is author and voice of 6 best-selling CDs of guided meditations on near-death experiences in his Into the Light series. He's a spiritual teacher, a speaker, and researcher on near-death experiences. He has served 2 stints on the board of the International Association for Near-Death Studies, or IANS, and currently serves as co-MC of their international conventions. Scott's first retirement was as faculty member at South Central College in North Mankato, Minnesota. So he's a local, you know. We might even talk about lutefisk or other things later on. Where he mentored small business owners. He is an accomplished business leader and former CEO skilled in broad range of leadership and business issues. His doctorate in educational leadership from the University of St. Thomas and his dissertation topic was Near-Death Experiences, Discovering and Living in Unity. Boy, do I have a question about that. That'll come up here in just a moment. Taylor is passionate about the ancient sport of curling, having participated in the Olympic trials in 1991. He and his wife make their home in Virginia's beautiful Blue Ridge Mountains. Let's welcome to the program Dr. Scott Taylor. Scott, how are you doing today?
Tim, I am awesome. And thank you for inviting me. I have been looking forward to this. This is great.
I as well, Scott. You know, okay, I'm going to start on a different angle here. We're going to get to know you in a different way first. Because of the Minnesota.
All right, do your best, Tim.
Because of the Minnesota connection here. And, you know, my brother went to the University of St. Thomas. As a Tommy, he was a business major, of course. It seems like there's a lot of business majors over there. I gotta think when you wrote your dissertation topic on near-death experiences, you might have got a look or two. What was the reaction when you turned that in?
Well, it was really interesting because when I was researching when I was researching schools to get my doctorate in, I went to, say, the University of Minnesota and asked them, can I write a dissertation that talked about God and spirituality? And this was through the School of Business and thinking about getting a doctorate in management. Mm-hmm. And they told me very directly, don't do that. It'll never get published. They'll freak out, you know, see if you can change your topic or go someplace else. Went across the street to the University of St. Thomas. And they said, you know, as a religious university, of course you can do that here. Not many people have, but go for it. So I had it arranged ahead of time, and it wasn't until I got to the point where I was trying to figure out what my topic was going to be that we seriously started talking about near-death experiences and how important that was to people's leadership abilities and how Because leadership essentially is, how do you present yourself to the world?
Okay.
And folks that have had near-death experiences come back profoundly changed.
Mm-hmm.
And so their leadership style changes profoundly. And that was of real interest to me. You know, what changes happen? And frankly, the question I kind of settled on was, how do they live with what they know? Because they know things, having had a near-death experience or a shared death experience, that the rest of us mere mortals, you know, don't have privy to until they have touched into that space again. So it was a profound learning experience, and the University of St. Thomas embraced it wholeheartedly.
Really?
And I'm really grateful that I had that opportunity, and you know, that I had wonderful, just amazing faculty members, and you know, people who were in my cohort. They were terrific. So I was supported all the way along the way. And yes, I did get a few raised eyebrows.
I was going to say, because, you know, for those of us in the audience that aren't from Minnesota, and there are quite a few of them out there, Scott, University of St. Thomas is typically known as a Catholic university. So, you know, to say near-death experience and anything that isn't biblical dogma on the Catholic side, you might get the, well, okay, sure, go down that road, but tread lightly.
I have to tell you, though, Tim, when I started doing my research, my dissertation chair, Bruce Kramer, really encouraged me to get out there and start testing out my ideas and speaking. And it was really easy for me to find places to speak, especially through churches. And I would tell you that 40 to 50% of the churches I spoke at were Catholic, and they were incredibly supportive because, let's face it, this really dovetails nicely with Catholic dogma, meaning we have a soul and the soul exists after death, and that we can go and have an experience with divine beings such as Jesus. And we can have experience with angels and being in this space that is entirely loving. All of that is very consistent with Catholic teaching. And so I received, you know, really no pushback at all from any of the churches that I spoke at. It did sponsor some really interesting philosophical questions and dogmatic questions, but that's just the part of, you know, wrestling with what is an idea and how do people think about it today? Because let's face it, we know a lot more today than we did 2,000 years ago when the Bible was written.
Very true.
And so how do we temper, you know, what those stories, whether they were accurate or metaphorical, with what we know in the that's based on science. And, you know, we know a whole bunch now. It's near-death experiences is one of the most intensely studied phenomena that's out there. And you know, and the jury's pretty well settled about how this works and what happens when people make their transition and where they go. And, you know, so that part's really nailed down.
I have to think too, there's one more part to that. And that other part would be what was written in the Bible that we're misconstruing as well. There may be a vision in there that we misconstrue as possibly, you know, not necessarily a near-death experience, but an otherworldly vision that, let's put it this way, it was not necessarily a vision brought untoward or unto a prophet, but might have happened because it was induced. Maybe someone was near death. They were out in the desert and maybe close to death.
There's a wonderful story about how Saul was on the on the road to Damascus. Mm-hmm. He was struck by the light, and he turned into Paul, the apostle, mm-hmm. Because he had a direct experience of God. Now, speaking of Catholics, you know that the University St. John's University, they yep. had the Bible, you know,
yes,
redone in calligraphy.
Yep.
It took them 10 years to do. Mm-hmm. And that particular passage, they refer to that in that Bible translation as a near-death experience.
Really?
Yes, they do. And when all that calligraphy, it's absolutely beautiful. And some would say that the story of Lazarus is the same thing, that, you know, Lazarus
mm-hmm. yeah.
died and came back and had this experience with God. So we have a couple of really profound examples that are in the Bible. And, yeah, you know, like everything else, how do you want to interpret it? But now that we know about near-death experiences, it just matches up one-to-one with what happened to Paul on the road to Damascus.
Correct. Let me take you in a totally different direction here, Scott, and it's just one of your interests, and I want to ask you this question in the worst. Being we both have Minnesota roots here, and we'll...
Yeah, sure, you betcha. Do your worst.
That's right. Yeah, you know. But I do it in a friendly way because we're Minnesota nice. Curling. Let's talk about curling for a second, as it's gotten out there into the ether. If you've watched any human interest story out of Minnesota, or if you've seen it on a national scale, Jared Allen, former Minnesota Viking, is in the curling world now, and he's somewhat serious about it. He's trying to take it to the Olympics. Mm-hmm. Is this something you've had your eye on or are familiar with? And do you have any advice for the former Viking if he decides he wants to try and go that route?
I would practice a lot. Mm-hmm. There, curling is a team sport, and there's no way to get around the subtle communication that happens between the person who's in the hack throwing the stone. Mm-hmm. There's two sweepers and then the skip at the far end who's directing the action. So there are four people that are involved in every single throw of the stone. And the communication between them is vital because, you know, the sweepers are testing the ice and the skip is watching the direction. So the advice I would have for him is to do as much with your teammates as you can on how do we have accurate communication between the person who's throwing the stone, the two people who are sweeping, and the skip at the other end. Because that will make or break the shots.
There you go. There you go. All right.
There you go.
Well, now we got a reason to get a hold of Jared Allen, so he'll listen to the show.
Yeah. And speaking for all your listeners out there, even though Minnesota is spelled with a T at the end, if you're on the range where lots of the curling happens, it's actually pronounced with a D.
Yes, it is. Yes.
Yeah, Minnesota.
It's Minnesota. Yeah. You don't say the T. Yes. I've heard some, if you talk to a lot of people from the East Coast, it's a very weird O. It's a soda. Soda.
Soda.
Yeah, soda. Sota, sota. It, yeah, and they make sure they hit that T hard. And the minute you say it the way it's supposed to be said, they go, "Oh yeah, you're from there." Yeah. And I'm trying to do the like an East Coaster. "Oh yeah, you're from Minnesota." Minnesota. I can't even do it. It's Minnesota.
We have the same thing. I moved to Virginia, the Commonwealth of Virginia, to become executive director of the Monroe Institute. And the same thing here. They can tell in a heartbeat that I wasn't raised here because I say Virginia wrong. It's more like Virginia. You know, I completely mess it up. So I just have to go and say, well, I'm from Minnesota.
How do you say Virginia properly? It's not Virginia.
Virginia. There's Virginia? There's emphasis on the gin. Virginia.
Virginia.
Yeah. That's as close as I can get, and I'm sorry for everybody that I have now offended.
I don't know. That's different. I suppose. That's weird. Well, I suppose everybody has their own local dialect, and I can't tell you how many emails I've gotten, Scott, when we do Supernatural News, as to how many local cities I'm butchering when I'm reading. So it happens on a weekly basis.
Speaking of churches, then, you have now been given absolution.
Oh, thank
for
you.
All of your mispronunciations.
Thank you so much. I now go to the operating table knowing that that's been forgiven. I that's one less thing on my plate.
Yes.
Let's talk a little bit about that. Before we get into your story, I want to talk a little bit, and I hate, first of all, let me throw out another disclaimer here. I absolutely hate when talk show hosts throw themselves out for sacrificial stories. So for me to be talking about this, I feel, and this isn't false modesty here, believe me, I hate talking about personal details on air simply because it seems very grandiose. It's very, oh, look at me, look what I'm doing, yay me. But the reason I talk about this is because I do believe it's on topic for the show, and that is what to do when you're in a situation much like a surgery where they may stop your heart. And you know what? I may leave this for the second part of the show. Let's leave this for the second part of the show.
That's a teaser. Way
yeah,
to go, Tim.
Yeah, I'm sorry. But with the little bit of time we have remaining in the first half here, you yourself have had a near-death experience, correct?
Technically, it's a shared death experience. Yes, I did.
What is the difference between a near-death and a shared death experience?
Good question. So lots is known about near-death experiences, and the broad stroke on that is that somebody was in a situation where their physical body is damaged, say a car accident, and it's so bad that the physical body dies, it ceases to function, and our non-physical body lifts out, goes into the non-physical world, has an adventure. In the meantime, somebody in the physical world is putting paddles or doing, you know, chest pumps or whatever, and they reanimate the physical body. Once that happens, you know, then the soul comes back into the physical body, and, you know, then healing can begin and you're able to tell the story. So that's a near-death experience. A shared death experience, think of it as your bedside in the hospital, and somebody that you care dearly about is making their final transition. And when they do, they invite that person, you, if you're sitting bedside, they invite you to go with them. And the two people share that transition experience. So it would include, you know, meeting the guides and going down the tunnel and entering into the light and being there at the life review, with the reunion of dead relatives, maybe encountering a divine being. And then at some point, there'll be this call that says, you know, Scott, you've gone far enough. You've got to go back. And the person who's making their transition moves further into the light for the, you know, kind of crosses that final boundary. So in a shared death experience, you get to literally share in all of what happens to a person as they move through their final transition. But there's no physical trauma to you. No. You know, you're just sitting in a chair next to the person in the hospital. Or you could be at home watching television, or, you know, driving a car, or just, you know, sitting on a bench somewhere. And distance doesn't seem to make any difference. In fact, about 60% of the people who participate in a shared death experience aren't physically present with the one who's making the transition. So it's okay. You can be close, you can not be close, but you get to participate in that in that experience.
So
that experience
questions.
Can be short.
Okay.
You know, it could be, you could be sitting there and you can just feel, you know, like Uncle Fred just pass through your body on his way to heaven. And you, as Uncle Fred is passing through you, you get a message like, hey, this is going to be great. I'm going to, you know, things are going fine.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in a great place now. So, you know, there's some sort of message that tends to be given to that person, or it can be very extensive, like I described, complete with guides and tunnels and reunions and divine beings and life reviews. I mean, you can participate in all of that. It's all available.
I didn't know it had a name, but you're describing something that my mother's father did when he died. And that was, again, I didn't know it had a name. When he passed away, I was asleep and I had a dream where I saw a star rise from the earth up into the sky. And at that moment, I knew he had passed, and he had passed in the middle of the night. And I don't know how I knew. It was because no words were spoken. It wasn't like it was blatantly obvious that it happened. I just knew Grandpa was gone. So I got up, I dialed the phone to my mother's house, and I said, before I could even say he's gone, isn't he? I heard tears on the other end of the phone, and I said, Grandpa died, didn't he? And they said, yeah, it had probably about 10 minutes ago. And I said, okay, I'll stop by Perkins and get muffins, because that's what you do in the Midwest, Scott, when somebody dies. Yeah. So in that respect, is that a shared death experience that somebody reaches out and just lets you know that, hey, it's time to go?
Probably more accurately, you'd put that under the role of an ADC. You'll see that referenced often. It means after death communication. So, you know, Grandpa visits you, or in that state, there's no such thing as, you know, time or space. So, you know, he can send you a message and says, you know, Tim, I love you. I've made my transition now. Thought you'd like to know. That's essentially what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And only it was done wordlessly. I mean, you just knew.
Yeah.
And it's one of those forms of communication that happen from or within the non-physical universe, is that you just know.
Yeah.
I'm going to put in my plug for that kind of language and communication, because what I have found is that English is highly restrictive. It's really not very good at communicating what is happening to people as they're in the non-physical world. And so when people come to me and say, I had this experience, it wasn't in English, but it was, you know, and then they start talking in metaphors,
mm-hmm.
which are wonderful. But so much more is communicated by not having it be in English, that there's a direct communication between a soul and the person in the physical,
mm-hmm.
that there is this real understanding about what's being transmitted, the information that's being transmitted, but it has so much more texture, and there's so much more nuance to the communication that's there, that it's really hard to put words to those. And it's very gratifying. At least I think so, that you have this communication come through and you know exactly what it's about. And it would take you pages and pages and pages to write it down in English, but it's communicated immediately in its fullness when you're in the non-physical world.
Yeah, it was an experience to me that, believe it or not, normally I can be very emotional when it comes to things like that with death. When I woke up with that message, I was very calm. It was almost like, well, you know, like you just got the morning paper and read the headline. You know, it was so surreal that it was just like, okay, well, you know, it was almost like it came with a numbing agent when I got the message.
Yeah, I'm not sure numbing agent is the right word, but I get your meaning.
Yeah.
So many times I've talked to people who, I don't know, the one that sticks in my head is this guy who was on the floor of his apartment, and the EMTs came in, and they're doing the chest pumps, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And as it turns out, it was this guy's best friend who was the EMT, and the one who's on the floor making his transition lifts out of his physical body, goes up to the ceiling, rolls over, and takes a look down on the scene. And what his thought was, I didn't realize that Jared had male pattern baldness. And doesn't that tell you just volumes?
It does, yeah, yeah.
A, it's not a surprise. You know, well, here I am. And B, it's there's no sense of wonder or magic. It just, you know, it feels like the next step. Okay, I was in a physical body. Now I'm not in a physical body. So what? You know, and you're looking around with some curiosity, and you happen to see, you know, Jared doing his thing. And it's all okay.
Yeah.
It's all like people describe it often as, you know, when you leave your physical body for the last time, it's no more difficult than taking the next breath or taking your next step. It's just like, that's what you do. And some of the folks that are really conscious will turn around maybe and say, thank you, body, for being a wonderful vehicle for me for the last 47 years, and then move on. But, you know, there's really not much emotion that's exhibited toward their physical life or their physical body. They are just, oh, this is where we are now. Done. Got it. And then off they go.
Interesting indeed. I tell you what, we're at that point where we need to take a break. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit about the most extreme shared life experiences, because I have so many questions about that and how you do that without almost losing your mind. We'll get to that. Later in the program, we'll talk a little bit about what to do if you're in surgery and all of a sudden you find yourself outside your body. We'll talk with that with Dr. Taylor. During the break, I want you to check out Dr. Taylor's books, the Into the Light series. We also have links in the description of this program on how to find Dr. Taylor's podcast. I believe it's The Afterlife Files. Is that correct?
The Afterlife Files. Isn't that a great name?
It is. It's a great name for a podcast. We want you to check that out as well. So we've got links in the description of the program for both of those. Check those out during the break. When we come back, more with Dr. Scott Taylor, shared death experiences and near-death experiences. When we come back here on the Best in Paranormal Programming, this is Darkness Radio. Welcome back to the Best in Paranormal Programming. This is Darkness Radio. I'm Tim Dennis. Our guest is Dr. Scott Taylor. We are talking about shared death experiences and near-death experiences. I got to tell you, Scott, you're opening my mind here a little bit, especially with the shared death experiences. Let me talk to you a little bit before we get into your shared death experience about the more extreme side of a shared death experience where maybe a loved one or someone you're close to reaches out, grabs you and takes you along for the ride, and takes you down that white light tunnel, takes you along to meet the people on the other side who are waiting for you, maybe even takes you through that life review. And let me start slow here, because I think that would be amazing. But two, I would also, the skeptical brain in me would say, did I really just experience that? Did I really just go through that? Or is this something I'm dreaming because I miss this person so much? One, I got to ask you here, Dr. Taylor, is this something that you find a lot of people who have shared death experiences question, that what they went through was actually reality? And two, is it something that verifiers are left so that they know what they went through was actually real?
That is a really good question. So what I have found with folks that have had shared death experiences or near-death experiences, and they're very similar, by the way, really similar, both in terms of what people experience and the after effects. Mm-hmm. What I have found is that the person who is making the transition, they have this sense of knowing. They know what they went through was real. Typically, it is realer than real. That phrase is used a lot, where they say, you know, what I experienced was more real than the physical life I'm living right now. So it's lots of detail, very clear about what happens. Now, think about that versus, is this a dream? You know, and the clarity of dreams and the amount of control that you have in dreams. Not so good. But in an experience of near death or shared death, you have lots of detail. You're very present. You are a co-creator in the experience. And you know without a doubt that that is real. Now, when you come back to the physical, of course, you could sit there. I did. And sit there and went, that thing that just happened to me, wow, that is just really outside my experience. Was it real? And so there's a period of self-reflection. Mm-hmm. I went through it. But, you know, what I came to was, yes, this is, I did enter into the non-physical universe, and what I experienced is there. And there is so much documentation now about what that's like and what it feels like. So, you know, anybody who has a similar experience can look it up and go, oh yeah, mine was like that. Details are different, but it's very similar. So, what? You know, as we were talking about before, there's this sense of knowingness. Mm-hmm. That is incontrovertible. I know this is real because it happened. And at the very core of my being, I know that this is what reality is like.
Let me ask you this. When we talk to people who've had near-death experiences, mm-hmm. the main lesson behind a near-death experience is to change the way you've been living, one, or to improve on your life in some way or another. Two, when you accompany somebody in a shared death experience, what is the benefit for you at the end? And especially if you're sitting through somebody's life reveal, if you're seeing somebody else's life, what is it that you're learning from it? And what do you pull away from that experience?
I'm going to augment that. And the people who've had near-death experiences, you know, some describe it as the cosmic 2x4, right? You know, yeah. It's just like somebody comes along and whacks you alongside of the head and goes, Tim, you know, how you've been living your life? Not so good. So, you know, and then you get a chance to fix it. Mm-hmm. Okay, so they give you a new perspective. That's only part of the people who have that. There's lots of different reasons that people have these experiences. One of which is to just taste what it is like on the other side, to give that experience of entering into a benevolent afterlife where everything is love. I mean, that is the only thing that exists in the non-physical universe is the love of the universe. And that is a profound awakening to realize that there isn't anything else. You know, there's no flip side. There's no dark side. It is profound, the love of the universe. So that is wonderful. And then the other is to, that is a, the non-physical universe is one of unity. It means that everything is connected to everything else. So we come out of that unity universe. And, you know, there's a part of us that lives in the physical, which is, you know, has this separate ego. But we are connected to the entire universe that's out there. And once we go back into the non-physical universe, we realize that there's no such thing as time and space. And so you have available to you the knowledge of the universe. All you have to do is to ask. And that information will come to you. And that means that when you come back into the physical, you realize there's part of you that is still connected to all of that. And so you begin to live your life differently because you realize that when we leave this physical body, we are just returning home to the love of the universe. There is no other option. We all go back to the love of the universe. Now, there might be some snags along the way as you, you know, are making your transition from the physical to the non-physical, but in the non-physical world, we are all just individualized bits of the love of the universe, and we just fold back into that again. And that profound knowledge really affects people when they come back and they live their life differently. And it wasn't so much that they got the finger wag and the 2x4 alongside the head. They got to realize there's another way of being. And, you know, and then it's like, okay, why am I here? Why, you know, knowing that I am part of the love of the universe, what am I doing here?
Can I take a tiny bit of umbrage with the it's all good out there with you?
Go for
Scott?
It.
Scott, okay, so one of the stories that was on Supernatural News a few weeks ago had to do with a former priest who had a near-death experience, and he didn't go to such a nice place. In fact, he believed he ended up in hell, and at that same time that he ended up in hell, there were demons that were there that were singing Bobby McFerrin's Don't Worry, Be Happy and Rihanna's Umbrella, which, I mean, we can sit and chuckle about because to us it sounds funny. To him, this was eternal hell and people were burning and it was scary and you know, there were screams, there was fire, it was hot. And there are, I believe it's something as, don't quote me as far as the exact percentage. I'm going to throw out the percentage. I want to say it's like 10 to 12% or something. Maybe it's lower. It could be 5 to 6% of people that have NDEs that end up in a negative experience. In fact, they end up in seeing something that is more like the, I don't want to say stereotypical hell, but it tends to be dark, hot, screams, you know, something to that effect. So how do you explain that? And if you get pulled into that in a shared death experience, what would that necessarily mean?
So for your listeners, write this down. Nancy Evans Bush. Nancy Evans Bush is the only person that has spent a significant amount of time researching what's known in the biz as less than positive near-death experiences. Isn't that a great acronym? And an LTP. And they occur for all different kinds of reasons, but, you know, typically one is the 2x4 alongside the head. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like you've been living a life, you chose to come here to have this life, you were going to do X and instead you're doing Y, and we want you to get back to X, so shape up and fly right. That's number one. Mm-hmm. Number two, which she found, which was I thought really interesting, was that it's Joseph Campbell. Remember him?
Mm-hmm.
He wrote about myth and had a bunch of books on myth. And one of the things he talked about was the hero's journey and how we as in stories and, you know, in myth, we leave our home and we gather some friends and we're confronted by an obstacle, and it's our job to confront that obstacle, overcome it, and move through this challenge in our lives. So the less than positive experience sometimes for people is that challenge, is that like, okay, here you are, you know all about what it means to be in, you know, in the love of God, and you how do you take agency with your life so that you can confront these demons or you can whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so then it's up to you, your creativity, your team that's with you, and, you know, you and your team figure out how to get out of this nasty space and reconfigure things.
Okay.
A third reason,
yep,
that people have a less than positive experience is just called attention getting. This is the lightest form.
Okay.
So think Harry Potter, right? And there was this scene where he's supposed to go through this trap door down into the basement somewhere to discover something. And sitting on the door is a three-headed dog that's drooling and, you know, mm-hmm, making all sorts of nasty sounds.
Mm-hmm.
Point of that scene was, here is a something that is scary. It's in your environment. And its purpose is to alert you that there's a message coming through. So the way to handle that is to be able to step back from the scene and go, okay, three-headed, drooling, nasty dog, you have my attention. What is it that you're trying to tell me? And almost immediately, that three-headed dog will morph into some other shape. Angel, monk, make it up. I don't know. It's some sort of shape that's familiar and supportive, you know, like maybe your guide.
Okay.
And they'll say, listen, we've been trying to tell you this for about 10 years, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, and the last reason people have near-death experiences, I don't know. It's just, there's a really small segment that when I do research, I sit there and go, they have a great life. They're spiritually whole. They're adept meditators. Or, you know, there's no reason that they should have this experience that I can think of.
Mm-hmm.
And so that checks the box of I don't have that knowledge. I don't have that, you know, omniscient perspective yet.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, to summarize this whole thing, in my research and the world that I have explored, what I have found is those less than positive experiences, the hell-like experience or the purgatory-like experiences where people are lost or confused in this world of gray, blah, blah, you know, pick your metaphor there. There is some sort of expectation, like I am not worthy.
Mm-hmm.
And I was mean and nasty to people, so therefore I should go to this place, or I expect to go here because that's what I've been taught as how things work. And all of those kinds of belief, I just call it the belief zone.
Okay.
We believe it. What it takes once entering into the belief zone is to be able to step back and go, you know what? I don't want to be here. And typically that's all that needs to happen, is to say, I don't want to be here. And I want to go to the light and be with the light or the love of God or Jesus or you know, name your divine being.
Right.
And typically that's all required. But sometimes, you know, you've got a team with you, your guides and loved ones that surround you as you make your transition. You know, and you can call on the troops and say, hey, let's figure out a way to not be here, because this is something that is associated with the physical world. It's associated with belief systems. It's not real. It feels really real, like this does here, you know, in the physical world where we are, but that's okay. You know, this is all just vibration. Everything here is vibration. So we can move beyond that into something that is beyond vibration, and that is the love of the universe. And that is the only thing that exists when we boil it all down. And, you know, I'm sorry your priest had that experience, and I'm really grateful that he's talking about it,
because
helps open up the conversation about, well, what can we do if we find ourselves in a situation? I'm now, this is your segue to, well, what happens if I'm having surgery?
Well, we'll get there in a moment. The one thing I want to ask here is this, do you feel that it's better to have the positive motivator of an NDE or a negative motivator of an NDE, or is it just the individual's experience?
It's the individual's experience. 'Cause I can tell you that I had, I talked with a woman who was an absolute jerk in her life, and she had what she felt was a less than positive experience. Mm-hmm. That was the absolute best thing that ever happened to her, because she was able to come back to the physical, right her life, make amends with her family as best she could, and to live a life that really expressed who she was instead of being this jerk of a person. And the flip side is also true, that people who have this blissful experience and they come back and go, I can't handle being here in the physical, because, you know, the love of the universe is just right over there, and it's hard to live here. It's hard to live in duality with hate and war and people, you know, we have physical bodies. They hurt when they don't work.
Right.
You know, this is tough stuff.
How do you deal with that? If you're someone who's had a near death experience, it's a positive experience. You know that there's that love on the other side. You come back and now you're starting to turn to depression because you realize that maybe it's not as easy as you thought it was going to be when you've come back.
The vast, vast majority of people come back and they realize that that this is a world of contrast. They signed up for it, and that this contrast that exists in duality helps bring us really incredible experiences. Good and bad, they're all good. But there's another segment of folks. It typically happens with children, believe it or not, who have an experience. And the problem is they weren't adults. They didn't have a long time to have their personality set.
Okay.
And so there's like no before. So there's like, they don't remember the contrast. Mm-hmm. Between being in the physical, now in an NDE, and back in the physical. So, you know, at a young age, they had this blissful experience, and then they come into the physical world, and it's hard.
I bet.
And they have a tougher time.
I bet.
And it takes some counseling to get them around. And gratefully now, there are counselors who are trained specifically to work with people who've had these experiences, meaning shared death or near death experiences, and they help people work through them as emotional beings. But back to my beginning thing again, vast majority of people are really grateful to be here in the physical life because they realize that being in the physical is a gift.
Mm-hmm.
And we learn so much about ourselves by being here in this world of contrast that they, even with all of the tough stuff that's around, they bless that too. And then when it's time to leave, they go, okay, cool, great run. See you later, bye.
And at least they have that verification that when it's time to go, they know there's something they're going to, and it's something they're looking forward to, which is is a leg up on a lot of us who might have that skepticism or that doubt. Scott, I got to know, what was the shared death experience you had? And before we get to my stuff and my garbage here, what was the shared death experience that you had, and how far did it go?
So I was in love with a woman. Mm-hmm. Her name was Mary Frances Randall.
Okay.
And she and her son, Nolan, were out sailing on Lake Washington, which is just outside of Mankato, Minnesota.
Minnesota.
Mm-hmm. Yep. On a beautiful summer day. On their way home, they were involved in a horrific car accident.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Mary Fran was killed outright. And Nolan had a really severe head wound, mortal head wound, and it took him 6 days to make his transition. That becomes important because in that intervening 6 days, Mary Fran was one of nine kids, so there were so many people coming from all over the country to hold vigil for Nolan was the first grandchild. And so, you know, all these people were converging on Rochester, Minnesota. Both Mary Fran and Nolan were taken to the Mayo system. Thank goodness. Mm-hmm. I mean, they received terrific care. Bless their hearts.
Mm-hmm.
All these people started to converge. So think of it, you know, she's got eight siblings and their boyfriends and girlfriends and, you know, spouses and uncles and aunts and grandparents and neighbors. And that's just her side of the family. And then there's mine. And, you know, we had 40, 50 people that were there in the waiting room. So many, in fact, that we divvied it up. We said we take 2 hour shifts and two of us would go in at a time and be with Nolan. The staff at the hospital told us that even though Nolan was in a coma that he never came out of, the last sense to go is the sense of hearing.
Okay.
So it was really important that we sit with him in the room and we talk to him. And so when it became time for my shift was from 3 a.m. to 5 a.m. in the morning of the sixth day. And Jannie, Mary Fran's oldest sister, and I had that shift.
Okay.
And we went and we had a book. We read him stories, you know, his favorite stories. We told him about his uncles who had gone throughout the Mayo system at midnight and stolen all the cushions off of the couches so that they could, you know, have a place to lay down in the waiting room.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, just told them funny stories, but it got to be about 4:45 in the morning. And Jannie goes to the end of the bed, looks at his chart, looks at all of the myriad of monitors. And she just shakes her head and holds her hand out to me and says, Scott, it's time to say goodbye. So we pulled up a couple of chairs next to Nolan's head and we told him that we were so proud of him. He was had been a very brave boy and that he had fought so hard to stay with us here in the physical. But if his mother, remember Mary Fran died 6 days before.
Yep.
But if his mother should come and pick him up, that was the right thing to do would be to go with her. And that we would always love him and we would always be proud of him because he was, you know, very special in our hearts. It's now 5 o'clock. We leave and the next shift comes in. Well, about 45 minutes later, the nurse comes into the waiting room and says, it's time. It'll be soon. So all 40 or 50 of us file into this little hospital room filled with monitors. And as luck would have it, I'm one of the last people to enter into the room. And it's already, you know, 4 or 5 deep around the bed. So I said, well, that's silly. You know, I'm just going to sit here on the windowsill next to Mary Fran's youngest brother, Willie. Mm-hmm. And you just wait. You know, I don't know how many of your listeners have held vigil, but at least in Nolan's case, it was very gentle, slow. And really, the only thing there was to do is to watch the heart monitor, you know, do its thing. And eventually it slowed and slowed and finally it flatlined.
Mm.
And when Nolan flatlined, what I experienced was Mary Fran coming across the veil and scooping her son out of his physical body. And they had this extraordinary, exquisite reunion that you could only imagine between a mother and son. And what surprised me, Tim, was that I got to experience that. I got to feel what it is that they were feeling. And then what surprised me even more was that the two of them, after their embrace, turned to me, came over and embraced me, and then the three of us went to the light. And when I was in the light, I was in a space that was beyond anything I could even attempt to describe in terms of its joy, its ecstasy, its I felt one with the universe. But most important was the three of us that were there, you know, Mary Fran, Nolan, and I, and we had a chance to affirm our love and affection for each other.
Yeah.
We had a chance to say a real goodbye because, you know, when they were coming back from sailing, I was at work, mm-hmm. you know, so I wasn't anywhere near the scene of the accident. And so we had a chance to say goodbye. And then we just had this really precious time of being able to be together. And then at some point, it just felt complete. You know, it wasn't words so much that it was like, we're good now. And then the two of them turned and went further into the light, and I came back to my physical body. So that's part one of a three-part story.
Okay.
I'll pause here for just a second. Yet,
sure.
You know, any questions about that first part?
You know, I don't. Other than I find it interesting that. You know, I guess maybe a little bit about the boy in that he, at this point, is he somewhat conscious or is he still semi-conscious in his ethereal body?
In his ethereal body, he's absolutely conscious.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, no, yeah. When he left his physical body, he brought with him all of his consciousness.
Okay.
Like Mary Fran and me, you know, the three of us, we're all equal.
Did
he might have been a little more hooked in than me, but you know.
did he seem like he recognized that everybody was around the bed? Did he realize that what had happened to him? Did it just seem like it didn't matter to him?
I have to tell you that I was so focused on my communication with Mary Fran and Nolan that mm-hmm. I wasn't really, you know, paying much attention
sure.
What else was going on?
Yeah.
And
I suppose that's
a good question. I'll have to ask him next time I talk to him.
Yeah, that probably seems like such an earthly detail to not worry about, but sometimes you wonder about that stuff, especially us here on this side we wonder about little things like that. Like, did they know that we were sitting next to them? Did they know how much energy we wanted to put into them to keep them here? And did that keep them here longer than maybe they should have been?
And the answer is yes, they absolutely knew that you were there. Hey, they can see you. And sometimes, yes, by being bedside, it holds the person in their physical body longer than it would have happened. When you talk to hospice workers, they'll tell you over and over again that very often people will make their final transition when everybody goes out to go have lunch, or they leave to go to the bathroom or something.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's not the energy holding them here,
yeah,
to the physical plane. They feel free to, you know, take that next step.
Yeah. Yeah. Second part, what happened with, now you've had your time and you feel like it's yep, run its course. What happens then?
So I'm back in my physical body and I'm sitting there on the window still. But what was happening while I was with Mary Fran and Nolan in the light, I was also in my physical body in the room with all of the other grieving relatives. I didn't have a word for it then, but I do now. It's called bilocation. Okay. I had two distinctly separate consciousnesses, one with Mary Fran and Nolan working at 100%, the other one in my physical body working at 100% in the room.
Hmm.
And I know this because I'm sitting there on this windowsill right next to Willie, and I'm in this state of ecstasy. It's like the love of the universe is trying to break out of my physical body, and my face has, you know, this supreme joy. And I had enough sense presence to be able to say, this is really inappropriate, you know, for the room.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Mary Fran died 6 days ago. Nolan just made his transition moments ago. People are crying and hugging each other, and I'm blissed out. If anybody had looked at me, they would have misconstrued,
yes,
what was going on. So the only thing I could think of, Tim, was to take and cover my face with my hands.
Yeah.
Which I did. I just sat there on the windowsill with my hands over my face, and until both parts of me got reunited again, and then I had a chance to, you know, kind of get my act together, and then I could lower my hands and, you know, hug and cry on each other's shoulders, and the things you do when a loved one passes.
Yeah.
So it was an experience that was certainly outside of the Presbyterian tradition I grew up in. You know,
right?
We just don't talk about that stuff.
No.
That the idea that you could witness somebody coming across the veil, that you could leave and go with them into the physical light, and in the moment of my greatest pain, meaning Mary Fran and Nolan leaving, I am also at the very same time in my greatest joy. So those two emotions are absolutely intertwined with each other. When I think about that experience, they're just, I can't separate them, because that's the way it was for me. I was in ecstasy and I was deeply grieving.
It's mind-bending. So,
there you go.
Yeah, very mind bending, Scott. I guess in a, you know, when you're grounded in the three dimensions and you try to wrap your head around why the ecstasy when someone is leaving you, it's hard to fathom. But when you look at the spiritual side of it, it's very simple and it's very easy, yeah, to wrap your head around.
You're merging back into the love of the universe.
Yeah.
It's an extraordinary experience.
Yeah. Is that the second and third part, or is there a third part to it?
There's a third part. So the third part is flash forward 15 years.
Okay.
And I'm at the University of St. Thomas, and I'm doing my doctoral work, and I'm doing the research for my dissertation, and I'm trying to find people to interview.
Mm-hmm.
And Mary Fran, her family, the women in her family, many of them had chosen lives in the healthcare profession. So I sent a note to her sister saying, hey, this is what I'm doing. I'm writing about this topic. Can you help me out? Well, one of the sisters writes back and says, well, I had a near-death experience. You want to interview me? So, sure. And the story is a quick one. She was at her parents' home, had gotten some new medication, went upstairs to take a nap, adverse reaction to the medication. The next thing she knows is that she's in this world of gray. And she's floating in this world of gray, and out of the gray comes Mary Fran, her sister. And Mary Fran is pointing at her and says in a really strong voice, you've got to go back, and go back now. To which the sister, wants me to keep her anonymous, so I'm just going to refer to her as the sister.
Sure, sure.
So the sister's response was, well, nice to see you too, Mary Fran. It's been a while. And Mary Fran, you know, does the finger wag thing.
Yep.
You know, and points to her and goes, you have to go back, and you have to go back now. And she just screams it, so much so that it startled the sister. And she opens her eyes in the physical world. And as she does so, what she sees is the back is a guy turning away from her. And then another person standing not far. Well, the guy turning away from her is an EMT. And he's turning to say to his partner, I've done everything I can.
Oh,
we've lost her.
Oh, my gosh.
And the guy, the partner who's standing there, is looking down, and he sees the sister opening her eyes, and he went, no. And they jump on her and they do their magic and take her to the hospital, and everything's fine.
Wow.
So she's telling me this story. I'm recording it for my, to be in my dissertation. And so we finish up. I'm packing up. And as we're packing up, I say to the sister, you know, I just had a thought. Remember when Nolan passed away? Said something really unusual happened to me the moment that he died. And I was wondering if anything unusual happened to you. And her eyes got as big as saucers. Taking that as a yes, I quickly unpacked my recording equipment, turned it back on, and I said, all right, here we go. You tell me your story first, and then I'll tell you my story. That way I don't prejudice your answer.
Right.
And here's what she told me, Tim. She said, Scott, I remember this exactly because I was standing on the opposite side of the room as you. You were sitting on the windowsill next to Willie. And when Nolan flatlined, what I experienced was Mary Fran coming across the veil, scooping Nolan up out of his physical body. They had this exquisite reunion that I was able to participate in. And then the two of them turned to me, embraced me, and the three of us went to the light. She used almost the exact same words as me as I did in describing what happened. I've got it on tape. It was remarkable. And any doubt that I had in my mind that I was made this up or whatever, gone.
Hmm.
Totally gone, because What it meant was here was a shared death experience that had been witnessed by the other. So the difference between our two experiences was that we didn't see each other. I didn't see the sister and she didn't see me, but we had the same experience.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm okay with that because, you know, my focus was on Mary, Fran, and Nolan and our relationship. And, you know, we had some things we had to finish, you know, we had to express our love. We had a chance to say our goodbyes. And I imagine, you know, that's what happened to the sister too. So that's part three, the fact that it was witnessed.
Okay.
And that the stories, you know, we verify the stories for each other. And that gave me great solace. It mm-hmm. gave me permission to talk about this because I really hadn't for 15 years, you know, after the accident, I didn't really tell anybody. And it was my time with the sister that, you know, gave me the confidence to really put it out there.
Let me ask you this before we move on from your shared experience, Scott, and this may seem like an odd question, but I think you'll follow where I'm going here. With a soul like Mary Fran, because it seems like she's the one who's the catalyst behind the shared death experience, that she's the one who's bringing people forward and sharing this experience, it seems like you would have to have someone who's a very highly developed soul to keep bringing someone's energy forward and through that veil back and forth. Does it take someone who's highly developed, maybe someone who's lived a lot of lifetimes or done a lot of soul work, or an older soul in order to do this type of work?
I don't know the answer to that question, but I do know the research now that's been done by William Peters on shared death experiences. It's really clear how it works now. One is that you have to have a heart connection between the person who's making their final transition and the experiencer, which in this case was me. Mm-hmm. And I had certainly had that heart connection with Mary Fran, but I also had it with Nolan.
Okay.
You know, he didn't know who his biological father was, and he had just turned 7. And, you know, as I was entering into his life, he wanted to have a dad like every other 7-year-old on the planet. Right.
Yeah.
And so there was a connection from Nolan to me also. So there's a heart connection there. And secondly, is that the invitation needs to come from the person who is in their final transition back to the person in the physical. So it was from Mary Fran to me, or Nolan to me. I'm not exactly which or both of them, how that worked, but I felt pulled into the experience. And the third requirement for a shared death experience is that I had to be open and receptive. Mm-hmm. Well, you remember my story. I'm sitting on a windowsill and all I'm doing is watching the heart monitor. I mean, there wasn't anything else really going on, and everybody that was in the room was in their own, you know, in their own space.
Yeah.
Doing whatever they're praying or whatever. So I was open and receptive. And the stories we hear about people who are not physically present and have a shared death experience, well, it's not unlike yours. I mean, you were sleeping when you had yours.
Yes.
Open
yeah.
and receptive.
Yep.
People are watching television. They're taking a walk. They're, you know, they're sitting there, you know, they're not actively grieving. They're not actively involved in some sort of, they're not in a Zoom meeting, you know, like
yeah,
we are.
Yeah.
and so that seems to be a requirement. And so between those three, you know, I was the perfect candidate. And I think that's how you increase your chances mm-hmm. is by having that heart connection and being open and receptive. And then it's up to the folks on the other side to, you know, make the invitation.
Once a channel is open, once you've done something that strong where you've accepted that invitation, you've gone across the veil, or they've brought you across the veil and then brought you back over again, or you've come back again. Is it something where you can make that transition again, where you can keep going back and they can keep bringing you back?
You know, that is like the perfect segue, because I have to tell you that it took me a little while to go through some of the grief. But once I realized what had happened to me, what occurred in my mind was, if I did it once, I know that I can do it again. I just have to figure out how. Mm-hmm. And I went on a quest. So right or wrong, what I figured out was that I would go to the ancient spiritual sites around the planet and see if there's enough residual juju from those spiritual sites.
Okay.
To see if it could propel me back into that space again.
Sure. You know,
so I went to the Sphinx, and I went to the Great Pyramids, and I went to the Machu Picchu and the Oracle of Delphi and Stonehenge. You know, I went all over the place. I went to more cathedrals than you can shake a stick at. You know, just there has to be some juice here. Well, essentially, crickets, you know, like nothing. I had great vacations, absolutely wonderful vacations, but I didn't get what I wanted to do.
Huh.
And so then I said, all right, so how about, do we need to know more? So I went to the seminary.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's great for your head, but it doesn't help this experience. And at around the same time, I also started working with people who were did things experientially. So I worked with shamans in North America and South America and over in Japan. And I started meditating. I tried TM. And then I found the Monroe Institute here in Virginia. And they use a special form of meditation that's augmented with binaural beat technology that helps put you in the right vibratory state in order to be in that space again. And when I tried out those meditation techniques, they worked. And I was able to reestablish connections with both Mary Fran and Nolan, and I'm able to go back there anytime I want.
Wow.
And they're available to me all the time now. But it took a while.
So is it safe to say that heaven is more a dimension than it is a permanent lockdown and afterlife?
The afterlife just is. It's like that statement, like I am.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just that is the love of the universe is what we all come from and what we go back to. And I think of it as a vibration, you know, that it exists in a dimension that has a different vibration than this physical dimension. And I've been told by those who know that it's not really a vibration, but it makes it easier for me to conceptualize.
Yeah.
And it helps, because as I practice my meditation, you know, what I'm doing is I'm ramping up my energy level, and that makes it a lot easier to use my intention to go into those spaces where I can have communication with Mary Fran and Nolan, or anybody else that I want to, for that matter, and then tool around that physical, non-physical universe.
You're telling a lot of people right now who don't feel like they have a psychic ability that they can reach back to a lot of loved ones they miss and at any time, and they can
visit. Anytime. Yep. It all takes is a pair of headphones.
Wow.
Yep. And at Monroe, and I would teach. I taught classes there for 35 years, and said, you know, if you're a willing participant and you have your headphones on, there is no option. You will be in an expanded state of awareness. The technology is that good. You just have to figure out how to interpret it. Because, you know, information comes to us 8 different ways. And it means that we have to, you know, be open and receptive to information coming. It might be visual. It might be auditory. You might feel it. You might know it. It might come as an emotion. You know, there's lots of different ways that information can come. And so that's the part where you train yourself. Like, okay, you know, what am I getting now? How am I getting it? And then, yeah, you can do it. It's incredible. And thank you for that segue, because, you know, that's what I do. That's what I teach people how to do, is to go back. And I use the cosmology of the near-death experience as a way for people to learn how to navigate the non-physical universe. So we meet our guides, we play in the tunnel, we go into the light, we have the reunion with the dead relatives, we meet divine beings, we have life reviews, we explore that area of life between lives. You know, Akashic records are there, the healing and regeneration centers are there, all the knowledge centers are in that space. And so it's wonderful. It's just, it's frankly, it's more fun than a person should have.
Let me ask you a couple of quick questions about this. When it seems to me odd that you would do a life review before your life is over. Is there a danger to that? Are you seeing things that maybe you shouldn't
before? Oh, no, because it's over? Covering what you've lived to date.
Okay.
You know,
is
like,
that,
okay.
Is that helpful for somebody that may potentially have something like PTSD something where they need that healing, where they need to relive something that maybe they forgot, or maybe they need to go back and do some trauma healing?
It's probably one of the single most healing experiences we can have. Just a little background. I mentioned in our time in the non-physical universe, we will encounter a divine being that loves us and knows us. And that divine being is with us as we do the life review. And their job is to love us through the experience. And so, you know, they help us interpret, they help us relive things, they help us gain perspective on what happened. Because when we do a life review, it's always done from 3 perspectives, might be more, but at least 3, which is like right now. When I have the life review, I will relive this as me. Mm-hmm. I'll relive this as you, Tim.
Okay.
You know, so I get to see what's going on with me, and I get to see what you're thinking and feeling. And then I also get to see it from the omniscient point of view. So that overview that says, okay, so how did that interaction between Tim and Scott, how did it affect the two of them, their families, their community, and, you know, how did they contribute to the knowledge of the human consciousness as a whole? Mm-hmm. And so we gain all different kinds of perspectives, you know, because I get to relive it and go, oh, that's what I was thinking at the same. But I get your perspective, and I get to see why this was designed the way it was. And okay, so for your viewers, if you have hung around long enough to hear this next thing I'm going to tell you is worth the price of admission.
Okay.
So you know, write this down or do something. So when we're going through the life review and we've got this divine being, mostly what they do is ask you one question. What did you learn? There's no judgment, zero judgment. If there's any judging that's going on, you judge yourself, but that's it. And they keep asking, what did you learn? What did you learn? What did you learn? So say you come across a scene in your life where, you know, I can think of one, you know, I'm at the checkout counter, it's not going well, and I'm a complete jerk to the cashier because, you know, she's holding things up and it, you know, okay. I can turn to my divine being and go, can I relive that? Can I just stop this now? And the divine being says, yes. Yes. So we, you know, it's just like, you know, ECR, remember those? You get to rewind it.
Yep.
And then play it again, only this time, instead of being a jerk, I'm an understanding guy. And I go, you know, what's going on today? Oh, my computer's not working and I'm not trained on this one. I'm trained in the, you know, in the old ones. These are brand new and Bob was supposed to train me. But, you know, you find out the story. It's not her fault, you know, and I'm compassionate and I go, you know what? It's okay. If it takes us an extra couple minutes to check out, I'm fine with it. Don't worry. Take a deep breath. It's all good. And I get to play that scene through. And from the omniscient point of view, I get to see the difference. How did that make a difference in our life with our family, our community, and to humanity as a whole? Mm-hmm. Did that contribute? Now, here's the cool part. That relived scene becomes part of my experience just as much as when I was a jerk. So I've got two parts of me, you know, two timelines that happened during that one brief segment. And so call it instant karma, call it repair karma, call it whatever you want, but it's a chance to give us another perspective on the life we lived and to say we can fix, learn from that experience. So that's one of the beauties of working with divine beings. Very is that they can help us all learn more from our experience here in the physical.
Very interesting.
Isn't that cool?
Very cool. Very, very cool. We only have a few minutes left in the program, Scott, so I want to hit some high notes here real quick before we leave. One,
let's go for it.
Okay, so one, I got the surgery coming up tomorrow. As we record this, this show is for Thursday, so this would be tomorrow that this surgery is taking place.
Yep.
Let's say I'm on the table, and I think I'm going. I think the way they work this deal with the anesthesia is that I'm going to be half in, half out. But if I all of a sudden discover I'm all the way out of my body, yikes! And looking at everybody from above. What do I do at that point? Do I do I try to ride it out and decide I want to go to the light and see what's going on? Or do I fight like hell to get back in my body? What do I do according to you, Scott?
Well, you can have complete confidence that whatever is supposed to happen will happen. So if you are supposed to go back to your physical body, which you will, just know that that's going to happen. I mean, you can't choose an alternate path. So we're good. So my recommendation to you is take a deep breath, look around and say, guide, where are you? And he, she, it will show up.
Okay.
They always do. And you have a conversation with your guide going, hey, you know, I wasn't expecting to be here, but I'm here now. What should we do that will, you know, give me great insight into my life and, you know, further enhance the path that I am going on once I'm back in my physical body? And your guide will say, I know exactly the thing. And then off you go on an adventure and you'll be brought back just in time and it will all be good. So that's the thing that is the difference between a near-death experience and a shared death experience that I teach anyway, is most people, when they have a near-death experience, it happens to them. They are in their physical bodies, and then all of a sudden they are thrust into a world, and they don't know what the rules are. They don't know where they are. They're just trying to figure things out, as opposed to co-creating the experience.
Okay.
So by just taking 2 seconds and going, "Dear guide, you know, you've always been around. You're looking after me all the time. Let's have a conversation and talk about how we can use this experience to the greatest advantage." And that will happen. And so now what you're doing is you're creating an experience because you know you can do it. You know that it's a possibility. And that's the easiest. That is the easiest thing. So yeah, that whole fighting to get back into your physical body, nah, don't worry about that. They will bring you back naturally anyway. They'll stick some drug in you. They'll wake you up, or they'll, I don't know, if they have to, you know, if your heart stops, they have to, you know, they'll shock you on there to get it going again. I don't know how your procedure works, but yeah. I'm guessing you're going to be alive and well the whole time. So it's more about, are you out or are you in?
Right.
Yeah, and then it's just about, you know, when they squeeze that stuff into your veins that says, "Wake up, Tim," that you'll come back to your physical body easily, gently,
right,
with now new information about who you are and what the universe looks like, and with a great connection with your guide, which you'll be able to carry on with from now on. It'll be a conscious connection.
Very true. Scott, I want to thank you so much for a very enlightening program. Unfortunately, we're up against a clock, and we're going to have to do this again, my friend. There's so much to go over, because we've only gone over the shared death experience. There's other things about NDE and other things that you do that we can talk about, including different meditations and whatnot, and meeting your guides, things like that, that you go over in your different books. You have the Into the Light series, which, again, we have a link in the description of this program. You also want to check out Scott's podcast, which is called The Afterlife Files. We have a link to that in the description of this program as well. Anything you want to add before we sign off today?
Sure. The Into Light series is, they're not books. They're albums of guided meditations.
Oh, okay.
So everything that we talked about, I've put down with the binaural beats so that you can experience this for yourself. And so, yes, please come visit me at neardeathmeditations.com, or go on YouTube and, you know, type in The Afterlife Files, and you'll get my podcast. And if you're on my website, I have a contact me thing, and I always respond to emails, you know, that come through the website. So please, you know, check this stuff out. It's really quite extraordinary, and stay in touch.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Scott, I want to thank you so much for being with me, my friend, and putting a little bit of ease into my Friday morning, because I got to say, there's a little anxiety going on there. And I'll know that
either it's going to go easily, or you're going to have a great adventure, which will also go easily.
Yeah, I'll either put it this way. Either I'll see a nice white light, or I'll be singing Rihanna songs with the devil, one or the other, come Friday. But at least I'll know I'll come back, right?
That's right. Come back, and all you have to do is say, "I don't want to be here."
That's right. I don't want to be here. Exactly. Scott Taylor has been our guest, Dr. Scott Taylor. Check out his links in the description of this show. And folks, I want to thank you so much for being with us this week. I want to remind you to take care of yourself and each other. Do something kind for somebody this weekend. You know, we are in the midst of winter, and even though we've had some decent temperatures this past week, it is bound to get cold here again soon. do yourself a favor, do somebody else a favor, feel good about yourself, go out and donate to some, either some shelters or help out some clothing drives, drop off a coat or a hat for someone in need, or just donate some cash to a homeless shelter that may need it or a soup kitchen that may need it, or donate your time. You could do that as well if you don't have the cash to donate. Do a good deed this weekend for somebody and leave the place a little bit better than what you found it. For Beer City Bruiser, for Mally Fox, for Jessica Freeberg, I'm Tim Dennis. Thank you so much for joining us again this week here on Darkness Radio and being a faithful listener of our show. You're appreciated among everybody else, or better than everybody else, we'll put it that way. But we also appreciate our sponsors as well. We want to thank HelloFresh, Blue Chew, and Microdose Gummies for sponsoring the program. And again, of course, we want to thank you, the listener, for tuning in to this program and keeping us going from week to week. We love you and appreciate you more than you could possibly know. Folks, we'll see you next week for the best in paranormal programming. This has been Darkness Radio.